Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest brazen attack on the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, with an apparent collusion between the DC Circuit's Republican judiciary and the Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell, who sent the president a letter on Friday vowing to block the renomination of the current head of the CFPB, Richard Cordray, until Congress passes a bill to neuter the bureau. Jeff Connaughton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins, joins us to discuss whether the banking lobby's Republican hirelings and the courts will succeed in eliminating any consumer protection from an industry that all but destroyed the economy. Then we will speak with investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who just returned from covering the elections in Israel and the riots in Egypt. We will discuss the secular and religious divide in Israel that was reflected in the elections and in the current horse trading going on now as a coalition government is being formed, and the same divide in Egypt between the secular youth who propelled the revolution now battling in the streets against the religious government that stole the revolution. Then finally, with today's Super Bowl celebrations underway in New Orleans, we'll look into the future of the increasingly violent game of football that has led to over 4,000 lawsuits from NFL players seeking damages, blaming the league for minimizing brain damage and its long-term effects. Veteran sports writer Robert Lipsight joins us to discuss whether the brutal collisions in football can be minimized without losing fans of this multi-billion dollar spectator sport. Joining us now is Jeff Connaughton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. Additionally, he served as special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House and then as special assistant to then Chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. He was featured extensively in the recent PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Connaughton.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And am I correct in suggesting this is a 1-2 punch here against the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and its head, Richard Cordray, in as much as the D.C. Circuit Court overturned the ability of the president to have recess appointments, one of whom was, of course, Richard Cordray, and in a ruling against the National Labor Relations Board, there's also a subsequent suit affecting the new Consumer Protection Board. They've essentially told the president that his appointees are void, if you will. At the same time, Mitch McConnell sending the president a letter on Friday basically saying that they're not going to reconfirm Richard Cordray unless he accepts a bill from the Congress essentially neutering the agency.
Well, the president has a constitutionally valid ability to appoint recess appointments. That's clear. The question is, when is Congress in recess? And the court in this case ruled that while a Congress is sitting, you know, normally after an election, you really count that as the new Congress taking its seat in January after the prior election. But during the 2 years of that Congress, what the president did was while they were not literally in session or were in sort of pro forma session or had left town for a few days, used that as an opportunity to say, okay, I'm making a recess appointment. And the D.C. Circuit said, no, that's not valid. You can only do it in the recess at the end of the Congress. So Cordray, who is currently serving as the acting director of the CFPB, he too was appointed during one of these so-called recesses. And until the Supreme Court rules, or the court rules on his particular case, I mean, his position is in jeopardy because of that court ruling. And yes, the second punch is that the Republicans, even though the Dodd-Frank bill was the law of the land, you know, in establishing that there shall be a single director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it'll be a part of the Fed, it'll be funded by, Fed monies, which come from fees applicable to banks. They're saying, we don't like the law of the land, which we didn't participate in helping to construct in the first place, and we're just going to simply block him as a minority.
Well,
and that's very troubling.
And, of course, this is the bureau that was the brainchild of now Senator Elizabeth Warren, and you work for Senator Ted Kaufman, who replaced Joe Biden, filling out his term. And of course, he was an unusual senator, your former boss, in the sense that he didn't take any money from anybody and just did the people's business and not the lobbyist's business. You pointed out, of course, that not one Republican voted for the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation that led to the construction of this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But I'm surprised, and you were featured heavily in the PBS Frontline documentary, The Untouchables, that asked the question of how come no Wall Street bank has gone to jail for almost destroying the global economy and causing this recession and impoverishing the lives of millions of Americans. And that answer still is hanging out there. And you were actually quoted in Sunday's New York Times column by Gretchen Morgenson asking about the Treasury's kid glove treatment of the big banks. But what the Senate's now doing is such brazen fealty to the banking lobby. I mean, isn't there any shame there? Do you think the American people, they must know what happened on Wall Street. They must know what happened to their pocketbooks, their lives, their families, their relatives. How come they're not mad at these people for getting away with it?
I wonder about this every day. I mean, there are certainly people listening to this show. There are people I talk to every day who are angry, who understand what's going on with bank power in Washington. But there's nowhere in our political system to go because the Obama administration, frankly, has been very pro-bank. I mean, that was the point of Gretchen Morgenson's column in the New York Times today, that Secretary Geithner was a friend for the banks, and that the banks rarely lose. And it all comes back to the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, because Elizabeth Warren's idea was that in the lead-up to the financial crisis, none of the bank regulators looked out for the consumer. They were all somewhat captured by the banks, and that there needed to be one seat at the table that was specifically for looking out for consumers, to be a counterweight to the power of the banks. And now the Republicans have banded together to try to neuter, as you say, even that seat at the table. So it's very discouraging. I think all people can do is continue to talk about it, talk to their senators and their members of Congress, and try to put pressure on them. And we'll see if in this second term of President Obama we have more willingness at the Justice Department, at Treasury, to stand up to the banks on occasion.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Connaughton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, firstly at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. Additionally, he served as special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House, and then as special assistant to then Judiciary Chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. He was featured extensively in the recent PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables. So, there's been some fallout from the PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables, with the resignation of Lenny Brewer, who is basically the assistant attorney general in charge of prosecuting Wall Street. And throughout the documentary, the PBS Frontline producer, Martin Smith, kept trying to find out from him why nobody's gone to jail. And he was breathtakingly evasive. Is he going to go back to Wall Street? Is this a part of the problem, this revolving door between Wall Street and Treasury and justice and back and forth? I mean, we've had...
Well, right. I mean, Martin Smith certainly made a very convincing case that the Justice Department has been too passive, too unwilling. I mean, there were whistleblowers on the program, dozens of whistleblowers telling stories about fraudulent mortgages, defective mortgages, the failure of the banks to sort of live up to the standards of what they were saying were in these packages, and yet the Justice Department had never even talked to them. I mean, PBS found two high-level insiders in the criminal fraud division at the Justice Department who said to PBS that there was, that justice was overly fearful about losing that there were no, you know, really active investigations going on, that, you know, the assistant director of the FBI admitted on camera that he had gone in on multiple occasions to talk to the assistant attorney general about cases and had been argued down, really, from the Justice Department bringing those cases. So it's just not very credible that the Justice Department can maintain that, you know, there was ever a sort of purposeful, concerted effort to hold Wall Street to account. And Lanny Breuer's own speeches, you know, in his own words, he's admitted that he was concerned about the health of the banks, that he didn't want, you know, a prosecution to cause fallout in the financial industry. And that's just totally inappropriate for someone whose responsibility is to prosecute criminal laws to be acting like he is some sort of financial stability regulator. So it was an effective documentary. I mean, I think Lanny Breuer was on his way out of the Justice Department anyway, but someone inside the administration leaked to the Washington Post the very next day after the documentary that he was leaving soon. So I think it helped to sort of cement the impression that the Justice Department and these task forces, the two task forces that the president has appointed, have just so far done a extremely poor job in holding Wall Street to account. And we'll never know if any could have been, you know, held guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, because as Martin Smith says, I mean, if you never take the bat off your shoulder, you never take a swing at a pitch, you know, you won't know if you're going to get a hit. And that's really what our Justice Department has been doing. They've been leaving the bat on their shoulder for the last 4 years.
So, Jeff Connaughton, as now we're about to have a replay of last year's fight over confirming Richard Cordray to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And in this letter that Mitch McConnell sent to the president on Friday, it's breathtakingly cynical, because we know what his motives are, which is to essentially neuter the bureau, which came out of Dodd-Frank, which came as a result of the Wall Street crash, and no Republican supported Dodd-Frank. And McConnell saying, quoting his letter, "As supporters of strong and effective consumer protection, we write to you to reaffirm our concerns over the transparency and accountability of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau." But what they want to do in the small print, which is the real intention, is they want to turn it into a board, as opposed to having a director who can actually direct the bureau. And you know, and all these other boards that we have, you can see what happens when you have a board, these nominees have to be confirmed by the Senate, which now the president can't get around, because they've at least in part blocked his ability to do recess appointments. For example, the Federal Elections Commission is a joke. I mean, it's completely paralyzed. You know, that's what they want, isn't it? I mean,
they want the power of the purse. They want to be able to appropriate money. And once, you know, there is an appropriate role of oversight by Congress into the role of these regulatory agencies, but too often members of Congress use their power of appropriation to bully the agency into not being aggressive, you know, because they're receiving contributions from Wall Street, and their Wall Street patrons are telling them, you know, this agency is being unreasonable. So they don't currently have that power over the Consumer Financial Protection. They don't have that power over the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. I mean, the main bank regulator, other than the Fed, is also run by a single director. It's also self-funded. So, you know, we don't have the Republicans saying we should have a five-member board and congressional appropriations of OCC, because, you know, they see that bank regulatory agency is already a very pro-bank regulator.
Well, isn't the evidence clear that the Officer of the Control of the Currency did not put forth one criminal referral to what happened after the 2008 crash?
Right. I mean, they've even admitted they don't believe that's their role. You know, whereas we know from the savings and loan crisis that it was only the criminal referrals put together by the bank regulatory agencies that provided the roadmaps to the FBI to actually develop these cases, which led to the prosecutions and convictions of hundreds of SNL executives. So we've had a complete cultural collapse in our bank regulatory agencies in caring, about helping law enforcement to enforce the law. And that's a big problem. And that's something that's happened since the SNL crisis, in which Senator Kaufman, when he was in office, tried to get the Justice Department to get the bank regulatory agencies to start helping again on that front. But, you know, too often they're all but a fraud enabler rather than a fraud enforce, an arm of the fraud enforcement mechanism.
But at this point, what's happening now with McConnell's letter and with the D.C. Circuit Court's opinion last week, essentially what we have now is that the only reform that came out of the aftermath of the 2008 crash, which was the Dodd-Frank bill, the main part of that bill they want to get rid of, which is the creation of this consumer financial protection bureau. So that's where we stand, really. It's and to me that is such an alarm bell. I'm astounded.
This is why Wall Street always wins. That's why I picked the title for my book, because their armies are relentless. They never leave the field. They never get tired. They never run out of money. They never stop fighting. You know, and the consumer voice in Washington has diminished to there are certainly a hearty band of people who are trying hard, but, you know, they're just completely overwhelmed and outnumbered and outfunded by the power of the banks.
And because your former boss, Senator Ted Kaufman, didn't take any money and was doing the people's business instead of the lobbyist business, he actually got something done. And that's the nub of the problem, isn't it? That our legislators are for sale.
Well, he would deny that. He always hated when the media said that. But, I mean, I certainly believe he is symbolic of what we would get if we got money out of politics. Because he was a full-time senator. He didn't have to spend half his day calling people for money to fund his reelection. I mean, when Senator Kerry gave his farewell speech at the Senate, I mean, he talked very bluntly about how, you know, we really have to do something about money in politics, because there's just too much effort by these senators to spend, you know, half their day with the people who are willing to fund their campaigns.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeff Conaton.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Conaton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. Additionally, he served as special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House, and then a special assistant to then-chairman Joseph R. Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. He was featured extensively in the recent PBS Frontline special, The Untouchables. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who's just back from covering the elections in Israel and the riots in Egypt. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He has been honored with the USC Annenberg Online Journalism Award for Investigative Reporting and is a Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. He just returned from covering the elections in Israel and the riots in Egypt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Yeah, great to be on with you, Ian.
And you were more recently in Cairo, right? You went from covering the Israeli elections to the riots in Cairo.
I arrived in Cairo as the crisis was brewing ahead of the constitutional referendum. And on the constitution that had basically been written by the Brotherhood-led government. And then from there, I headed into Israel-Palestine and then returned to Cairo recently, right after the killings in Port Said, and just the country had descended into chaos again when I arrived. So it seems like the clashes just were following me everywhere I went.
Well, in the opening introduction, I posed framed our discussion in terms of the secular and religious divide in Israel that was reflected in the elections and in the current horse trading going on as they try to form a coalition government. And the same divide exists in Egypt between the secular youth who propelled the revolution, who are now battling in the streets against the religious government that stole the revolution.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a secular religious divide in Egypt. The youth in Tahrir, many of them were very religious. They were, you know, many of them were extremely poor, but they weren't aligned with the Brotherhood and their tightly organized movement until towards the end of the Tahrir events, when the alliance kind of came to bear. The Revolutionary Youth cut, you know, an alliance of convenience with the Muslim Brotherhood, and many people made a tactical vote for Morsi, who supported the revolution. And now what they're finding is that Morsi is that the Brotherhood has an authoritarian agenda that's remarkably similar to Hosni Mubarak. I actually just got off the phone with Hani Shukrala, who is the longtime editor-in-chief of Al-Ahram, which is the state-owned newspaper in Egypt, the major newspaper of record in Egypt, and he's a left winger. He's a major supporter of the revolution, and he's basically being forced into retirement because the Brotherhood is trying to impose its agenda on this state-owned institution. And he sees it across the board in the media, and including in private media. They're using legal tricks and intimidation to bring private media to heel. So people are disturbed about an authoritarian agenda in Egypt. It isn't necessarily about religion as much as this movement, which has been out of power for 50 or 60 years. They've been tortured. They were a dissident movement, and they've been planning for this moment for a long time. They're very secretive, and their power is in the provinces, a lot like the Christian right in the U.S., where its power is in the red states. They speak a rural discourse. And with the events recently, you have youth in Egypt who are rising up basically for just a basic cause of human dignity, bread, and freedom. It's kind of their slogan. And they're getting killed one after another. They're getting killed. And they're sick of getting killed, and they're sort of descending into nihilism. And at the same time, the Brotherhood is losing legitimacy. It's completely lost the cities. And their vision is crumbling and being discredited. So I think this goes beyond the religious and secular divide, and it goes to basic revolutionary vision and the fact that the Brotherhood has been discredited as a potential force for moving the revolution ahead.
So, Max Blumenthal, is this to say then that the revolution continues?
It continues, but 2 years on, there's no leadership. And so, you know, what I witnessed in Cairo for the last 4 days I was there were youth who have now taken on, many of them have taken on the tactics of the Black Bloc that we saw, you know, in Los Angeles at the DNC protests in 2000, throwing rocks at cops. We saw them in Seattle. And now they've come to Cairo, and they claim that they're there to, defend the revolutionary protesters who keep getting killed. But basically, we're on the corniche on the Nile for 4 days straight, just throwing rocks at cops, and the police would fire copious amounts of tear gas. I mean, there were parts, entire neighborhoods in Cairo that were clouded in tear gas. And this just went on without any real meaning or direction. So there's a lot of consternation, I think, from within, among intellectuals in the revolution and people, political supporters of the revolution, wondering, where is this all going? Is this just going to be one ongoing street battle? Where's the vision? And I think one of the biggest problems was that, you know, I mean, the revolution was led by a revolutionary youth organization, and they were brilliant in organizing the 18 days in Tahrir Square. What they did in just controlling the situation, maintaining security, was brilliant. But when Mubarak was deposed and he stepped down and everyone celebrated, they made no demands. For example, they didn't demand that the army resign. They didn't attempt to impose themselves on the state. They basically let these elections go forward, which brought Morsi to power. And now, you know, we're in this crisis. And behind the scenes, you have the army, the Egyptian army, funded by the U.S., sort of this corrupt institution, which owns one-third of the state and is in cahoots, at least temporarily, with Morsi, who's guaranteed them all kinds of promises. I don't know what they are, but the army's just sitting there and watching the opposition and the Brotherhood battle it out. And they could, you know, make a power play at any moment. So I think this is a lot of people who supported the revolution and continue to support it are just concerned about the direction it's going in, especially from a tactical and political point of view.
Again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He just returned from covering the elections in Israel and the riots in Egypt. But to some extent, you can't blame the young people who brought about the revolution that toppled Mubarak and then had it stolen out from under them by this collusion between the military and the more extreme wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. It looks as though, I don't know what the motive of the military are in pushing wanting this outcome, the socialist and the moderate Islamists to combine got more votes, but because of the runoff, French-style runoff, it ended up with between a relic of Mubarak's against Morsi. And of course, the referendum that Morsi pushed through was very, very reactionary. And of course, there's also the role of the Saudis, who funded the Salafists, who even further to the political extremes as well in this mix. So I guess what I'm saying, Max, is that I can sympathize with the frustration. You described it as nihilism on the part of the young.
Yeah, I mean, maybe nihilism was the wrong choice of word, although you really get a sense when you're at the corniche at night and you're in the middle of these clashes, as I was, and everything's dark except for, you know, the light of burning tires, and this is just going on and on, there's just a dark, very grim mood and an apocalyptic atmosphere in Cairo and the country. People are afraid, frustrated, angry. No one knows where this is going. The country seems ungovernable at this point. And then you have the U.S. Qatar is basically propping up the Brotherhood. Al Jazeera Arabic is almost completely in bed with the Brotherhood right now. And then you have the U.S. kind of sitting back and watching, and it seems to suit the U.S. pretty well, because the Brotherhood, notwithstanding Mohamed Morsi's, you know, statements about Jews being apes and pigs, which was I think leaked intentionally recently, the U.S. is enjoying the fact that the Brotherhood seems to be very nice on the issue of Israel, and that they're continuing these Mubarak era deals where Egyptian exports of textiles have to contain 12% components from Israeli manufacturers. These are extremely unpopular among the Egyptian public, but they're doing it because Washington wants it. Washington wants to preserve the treaty between Egypt and Israel. So the Brotherhood is really, really working to preserve its relations with Washington as it imposes an authoritarian agenda, as the state sort of deteriorates. The economy is collapsing. Morsi's had to impose rules on how much currency people can take out because the Egyptian pound is falling so dramatically against the dollar. I mean, I was living like a king as a journalist in Cairo. And, you know, the U.S. doesn't seem to really care about from my perspective, about how much people are suffering. there. It's because the scenario is working out so well for itself and for its ally in Tel Aviv.
So let's turn then, Max Blumenthal, to Tel Aviv and to the Israeli elections that you covered. Now, there was a certain celebration going on amongst American supporters of Israel on the liberal side, who represent the majority of American Jews, who by, I think, a 70% margin voted for Obama over the Republican, whose name I've forgotten. who was, you know, in the pocket of both Netanyahu and Netanyahu's biggest backer, Sheldon Adelson. And David Remnick did a profile of this right-wing pro-settler, Naftali Bennett, which alarmed a lot of people. So then there was this big sort of sigh of relief that the centrist candidate won as he didn't win outright, but he came in second, and that he's forming a government with Netanyahu. But you're saying, wait a minute, no, it's not quite as centrist, and this is really what we're going to end up there is a right-wing government, right?
Well, maybe it is centrist. I mean, the Israeli center supports the settlements to a great degree, is extremely opposed to the international consensus for a two-state solution, which includes giving up East Jerusalem to a Palestinian capital. So I was hanging out with many of the members of the far-right party, Bayit Yehudi, whose leader, Naftali Bennett, was expected to get like 16 seats and become the second or third largest party in Israel. Their platform called for annexing 60% of the West Bank, dissolving the Palestinian Authority, and basically bringing the settlements into quote-unquote Israel proper, which would have done away with the farce of the peace process by which Israeli leaders continue to pay lip service to two states while they move literally hundreds of thousands of people into the West Bank. So I was kind of welcoming this development because it would at least shake up the status quo. But what wound up happening was that the status quo was solidified with the surprise victory of Yair Lapid, the son of an Israeli political veteran who was aggressively secular, extremely against the ultra-Orthodox and the benefits they receive. His platform called for forcing the ultra-Orthodox to do army service, and that was one of his only clear positions. Yair Lapid, who's the head of the newly formed Yesh Atid party, actually spent more time in L.A. than he did in Washington. He was the former head of New Regency Studios in Los Angeles. He was a Hollywood guy. I mean, as you know, being in L.A., there's a lot of Israelis in Hollywood.
Right. Well, of course, the guy that that headed up, that's the head of New Regency, is himself, he was actually an Israeli spy, was he not?
Yep.
Involved with a pun?
Yeah, it was Arnon Milchan.
Arnon Milchan, yeah, yeah. He was involved with an American executive who had to escape to Israel. They were selling Krytons, nuclear timing switches, out of Canoga Park, and the FBI did a black bag job. Discovered Milchan, and Milchan sort of still. I think the FBI is still after him. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, here you have a guy who's, you know, Milchan's been behind so many Hollywood blockbusters. He's a millionaire, if not a multi-millionaire. And he's a huge funder of Yair Lapid. But beyond that, this speaks to Lapid's sensibility. He understands American pop culture. He's a very sort of attractive but completely vacuous figure who has no political vision. And he happens to be very anti-Arab. I mean, if you read his columns, for Yediot Aharonot, the Israeli paper, he said in 2007, you know, I hate the occupation just as much as those crazy leftists, but I don't want Palestinians to cut my child's head off with an axe. So we need to maintain the checkpoints and maintain the separation wall. He recently, upon coming into power, after winning 19 seats in this stunning victory, outright rejected any coalition with any Arab party, which is, you know, standard Israeli practice. no government has ever allowed Arabs into the coalition. Beyond that, he rejects giving away East Jerusalem or any part of East Jerusalem. He's in favor of annexing the major settlement blocks, which also happen to be the platform of the Labor Party. And more than that, I mean, just looking at the big picture of this election, the occupation, the settlements, the peace process, these weren't really issues in this election. Israelis didn't want to discuss it. They feel like, that's over. We're not giving up the settlements. It's kind of like a de facto one state. As long as we don't annex the West Bank and Washington keeps the aid rolling in, everything's fine. So the election was conducted over kitchen table issues and the issue of the ultra-Orthodox not serving in the army. And, you know, so the status quo has been solidified, but with Lapid in a Netanyahu coalition, as opposed to someone like Naftali Bennett, the far-right settler who I mentioned earlier, who will also be in the coalition, but not as powerful as Lapid. Netanyahu is, I think, stronger in the eyes of the U.S. because he can make Lapid his foreign minister. And, you know, the current foreign minister is Avigdor Lieberman, who has to basically be hidden in the attic.
Well, he just got tried and convicted. So
he'll reemerge. But you have a mafia-linked guy who incites against Arabs every time he talks. And then you have Lapid, who's sort of an attractive figure who can come to the U.S., go to AIPAC and meet with Hillary or Clinton or meet with John Kerry and speak the language the U.S. wants to hear while Netanyahu continues to settle thousands of people in the West Bank. While I was in the West Bank, Netanyahu has authorized the building of hundreds of new settlement units in the E1 corridor. This would effectively isolate East Jerusalem from the West Bank forever. And a group of Palestinian activists set up sort of a protest village in the E1 corridor, and I watched as they were violently evicted by Israeli border police. I mean, they want to build these settlements no matter what.
Right, and the significance of these settlements is that in closing off East Jerusalem, they're closing off East Jerusalem to the entire Islamic world. In terms of the third...
Well, it's more closing it off to the Palestinians of the West Bank relegating them to a de facto Bantustan.
I understand, but it's symbolically to Islam, this is the third holiest shrine, the Dome of the Rock. And that's very inflammatory as far as Islam's concerned. So just in the last couple of minutes, Max Blumenthal, the pro-settler guy, Bennett... So in terms of this secular, Lapid ran on the secular anti-Orthodox ticket, but this other guy he's not entirely pro-Orthodox, is he? It's a different form of he's sort of a nationalist, isn't he? A right-wing nationalist.
Naftali Bennett it reminds Israelis of their neighbor, even though he wears a kippah, but it's very discreet the way he wears it. And he's a handsome guy. He's a former commando. He's a high-tech millionaire. He dresses in, modest clothing. Doesn't really have religious trappings. Doesn't speak necessarily religious language. He had all these slick PR agents when I met him surrounding him, kind of keeping me at bay. But he is a religious nationalist, and he represents the ambitions of the religious nationalist camp, which believes that they have a messianic vision of the land of Israel that the ultra-Orthodox don't have. The ultra-Orthodox don't care about a Jewish state. It's kind of why they have to be bought off with all these benefits. But the religious nationalists have had this vision, for almost 100 years of riding the secular state like a donkey. Until they finally take over all the institutions of the state, which they're rapidly doing. This is what Bennett represents. I mean, they've taken over they have the deputy chief of staff of the army, the head of the Shin Bet. All of these major institutions are controlled by religious nationalists. And they the army is really their base now. 40% of the officer corps is religious nationalists. And so they would like to bring the ultra-Orthodox into the army as well. This gives them greater influence, actually, among the ultra-Orthodox youth to indoctrinate them. And so they share a common vision with Yair Lapid, whose party campaigned on forcing the ultra-Orthodox to do army or national service. So where does this leave the governing coalition. There are two major ultra-Orthodox parties, Shas and United Torah Judaism, who have to be left out of the coalition in order to force the ultra-Orthodox to do any kind of service. And that means that Lapid and Bennett are the natural coalition partners of one another. That means that you will have, you know, a major far-right pro-settler party in the Netanyahu government no matter what because of this ultra-Orthodox issue. And that does complicate things for, you know, Israel promoting its image abroad as, you know, a country that wants peace, because you have a guy, Naftali Bennett, as savvy and attractive as he is, who says, we want to annex 60% of the West Bank. We want to dominate the Palestinians forever and simply manage the conflict. In my opinion, that's what Israel's currently doing, but he wants to officialize it. And so because of the ultra-Orthodox issue, he has this almost certain role in the next coalition.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Max Blumenthal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He has just returned from covering the elections in Israel and the riots in Egypt. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about America's favorite sport that is increasingly under scrutiny because of the enormous amount of brain damage caused to the players and the lawsuits piling up against the NFL. شهداء علشان يعلوا في مصر وقفوا يهتفوا شهداء وما همهمش يموتوا فيها وينزفوا شهداء Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Lipsight, who's a longtime sports and city columnist for The New York Times and the author of the recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, just out in paperback, and Sports World, An American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for the NBC Nightly News. And in 2001, he won the American Library Association's Margaret A. Edwards Award for Lifetime Achievement in Young Adult Literature. His young adult novel included Contender, One Fat Summer, and Center Field. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lipsight.
Hi, Ian. It seems like kind of a violent day for you. Wall Street, Israel, and football.
Well, you know, everybody's stacking up on their potato chips, and people are going to be showing up soon to watch America's favorite blood sport. But just recently, Robert, the president, in an interview with the New Republic, said, "I have to tell you, if I had a son, I'd have to think long and hard before I let him play football." So, do you think that football is going to be affected at the youth level? In other words, are parents going to be starting pulling their kids out of these Pop Warner youth?
I sure hope so, Ian. I think that anybody who at this time, you know, has a kid in Pop Warner or Pee Wee football should be arrested for child abuse with what we know now. It's as if with the 4,000 lawsuits against the NFL by former players, we kind of have the feeling that, you know, your head got crunched in your 10 seasons with the Green Bay Packers. But on the other hand, you know, you were well compensated for it and you were an adult. But I think that the truth really is that it's a lifetime of small insults to the brain, starting when you're, you know, 8, 9 years old and banging helmets with another little kid, that really adds up to these problems. But getting back to, you know, your your quote from the president. Number one, it's really about time. I wouldn't let my son play high school football 30 years ago. You're still angry about it. But more important, in that New Republic interview in which he discussed football, the discussion had come out of a discussion about gun violence. And I think that it's almost impossible to look at football and the ramifications of football in America without looking at some other things. First of all, football is the last bastion of masculinity, faux masculinity, traditional masculinity, whatever you call it, in America. In just recently, and this is after the concussion discussion began, women were admitted to get killed in combat, which is, I guess, a progressive thing. And there's been this assault on assault rifles. And the whole attack on guns in America is kind of an attack on traditional masculinity as well. So that's why, metaphorically, football is so important. And why any kind of assault on the violence of football, making it a feminizing football, as some critics have said, would be a real attack on an aspect of American culture. I think it would be very hard to change football and keep it as popular as it is now. I mean, I think, you know, flag football, touch football, these are wonderful events. It's really fun to play, but they're really in the category of ultimate frisbee.
So, Robert Lipsight, you're talking about a broader issue of cultural violence here in the United States, and it's certainly come to the fore following the shooting in of the school children in Connecticut. And obviously the NRA is trying to deflect the argument by blaming it on the movies and on violent video games. But on
but
the other...
Is it interesting, Ian, that they've never blamed it on football?
Well, this politically, they know what their constituency is, right?
Right, exactly.
But the point is, though, Robert, is that you can blame a lot of it on Hollywood and on video games. I mean, they're not wrong. They're just right for the wrong reasons.
Well, I think, you know, of course. I mean, I think to focus totally on guns is ridiculous. People are shooting the guns. Unstable people are acquiring the guns. The whole idea of shooting people. I mean, the guy who wrote American Sniper, the guy who killed from the sniper position, who killed more Iraqi enemies than anybody else, and now is taking, veterans, troubled veterans, in a therapeutic situation, was just murdered yesterday on a gun range when he took a 25-year-old vet, you know, who had
PTSD
problems.
Yeah, PTSD. So, yeah. And when, by the way, PTSD is not that different from what I understand. In fact, these explosions that the U.S. servicemen survive in these IEDs that they survive in both Afghanistan and Iraq has a similar effect. It's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, which is because of the brain being jolted around so much and so often. Now, in terms of the National Institute of Health, they autopsied the brains of 34 deceased NFL players, and 33 of them were diagnosed with CTE. So there's a connection there. I mean,
there's absolutely a connection, and this is empirical. But a friend of mine, a former NFL player named Jimmy Stewart, he was known in his time as Mad Dog. He's one of those linemen who really came in to kill you, but he has progressed since, and he is a licensed therapist now. And he basically works in what he calls hyper-masculine communities, which is the military, police, and firefighters. He works with them. And he is going around making exactly the point that you're making, that there is a real connection, he believes, between the kind of damage, the head trauma damage, that those guys are getting and how they deny it, as with NFL players. I mean, there is a culture in all these places of being brave and stoical and taking a certain pride in, quote, getting your bell rung, which, sure, of course, is what we now know is a concussion and is a very dangerous injury.
Yeah, and of course, unlike the NFL players who get compensated with millions of dollars, the soldiers don't get anything like that compensation.
Nor do they get very good care afterwards.
So again, I'm speaking with Robert Lipside, longtime sports and city columnist for the New York Times and the author of a recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, just out in paperback, and Sports World and American Dreamland. He's been a correspondent for CBS's Sunday Morning and for NBC Nightly News. And in 2001, he won the American Library Association's Margaret A. Edwards Award for Lifetime Achievement in Young Adult Literature. His young adult novels include The Contender, One Fat Summer, and Center Field. So let's try and connect some of the dots here, Robert Lipside, in terms of football. And I guess the real question is that can the league, the NFL, minimize brain damage and its long-term effects, which they've been in denial about, and whether the brutal collisions in football can be minimized without losing fans in this multi-billion-dollar spectator sport. So I guess that's my question. What is?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, I watch football, and I used to, you know, I covered football, and it's, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of a guilty, it become a kind of a guilty pleasure. I enjoy watching the game. I enjoy the violence. And now that we know, I mean, actually, now that we know that it causes so much damage, there is even a more a real sense to it. These are not cartoon men that we're watching. These are real guys who are using up the equity of their bodies to entertain us. So I love watching it. You know, I'm kind of torn. What do I like better? Watching 250-pound guys probably on heavy juice, slam into each other, or a long, wonderful arching pass, at the end of which the receiver might very well get hit really hard. You know, I feel a certain conscious pang, you know, watching this, and I know that you know, I didn't let my son play football, and I'm sure not going to let his son play football.
Well, but for example, in rugby, the players don't have the kind of protection that American footballers have, particularly with the metal helmet. And the metal helmet seems to be both a form of protection and a weapon, too. That does a lot of the damage. I don't know what the statistics are in rugby, but my understanding is that they don't have the same kind of brain damage. Is there any way that you can make American football more like rugby?
Well, my rugby friends seem to be really tough and crazy guys, and most of their injuries seem to be soft tissue injuries. But I think in the same way that it seemed as though the advent of boxing gloves caused more brain injury among boxers, I mean, before that, you know, they would break a knuckle by the second round and not hit so hard anymore. I think the same thing, you know, might really be true if you didn't have those, you know, iron helmets slamming into each other. You know, I don't think that they simply wouldn't hit each other as hard. But I think that there have to be much stronger rules about head-to-head hits, and even more important than that, Ian, is there is a a medical culture within the NFL that has really been deleterious to the health of football players. I remember for years and years they would be shooting up these guys with all sorts of painkillers to get them back on the field, whether they were ready to go or not, so they can hit each other some more. I think that, you know, doctors certainly were complicitous in all the years that the NFL said there's no connection between our game and head trauma. So I think that there are a lot of things that they can do in terms of rule changes to make the game safer. But in so doing, they're not only going to turn off the present fan base, but they're also going to turn off the players, many of whom really grew up in this, quote, manly culture of hitting hard.
Well, just in the last minute there, a lot of, when I talked about connecting the dots, you had the murder-suicide in December of the Kansas City Chiefs linebacker, and then you had Junior Seau, who committed suicide as a result of his brain trauma. We're going to have a lot of this collateral damage, aren't we? If there are 4,000 lawsuits from former NFL players, that's just going to increase, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, I think that there are so there are so many things that could be done, including probably more close psychological examination of these players. I mean, Jevon Belcher, the guy who shot his girlfriend and then shot himself in front of his coach at the parking lot for Kansas City Chiefs, was obviously not a stable personality who should not have had guns. I mean, this takes us into another area, but certainly maybe he was taking steroids, which is another thing. I mean, why are these guys so big? I mean, you have these incredible specimens, 350 pounds, and they can run and move like much smaller men. So these are, many of these have to be guys on juice.
This is obviously we've really tied some connected some dots here, and I think we need another conversation. And I thank you for joining us here, Robert Lipsight. We've just run out of time. I'm sorry.
My pleasure. Have a good game.
You too. Again, I'm speaking with Robert Lipsight, longtime sports and city columnist for the New York Times and the author of a recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, just out in paperback, and Sports World, An American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for NBC Nightly News. And in 2001, he won the American Library Association's Margaret A. Edwards Award for Lifetime Achievement in Young Adult Literature. His young adult novels include The Contender, One Fat Summer, and Center Field. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.